The next thing, you know, that, and this is a little bit of a refresher course for some, but the business judgment rule provides that directors will not have liability if they decide to operate an insolvent entity in the good faith belief that profitability may be achieved, even if it results in greater losses. And this is important. I mean, I think that there's a tendency of people to think of this as there's only one possibility. If you are insolvent or encountering difficulty, you need to effectively think about how to liquidate or sell the business. And you can't change direction of the business or implement a plan that has some uncertainty surrounding it. And the case law is pretty clear that the board can take risks, can implement plans that may result in short-term greater losses than they've experienced to try and right the ship. It's advisable for the boards to not have what you do perceived as a Hail Mary. And I've had clients before that have said in the equity, if they're in equity, hey, what's to stop us from really just trying something that's extreme to try and basically get back our equity value? And I think the answer is, you know, it needs to certainly pass a smell test. And again, we'll get into financial advisors and things later, but I think getting third party advice on the credibility of that plan is important. I think I'd also, I'm sorry, Rita, can you go back a sec? One of the things that people also need to be aware of in the business judgment rule is that interested or conflicted directors don't have the benefit of the business judgment rule, and they're going to be subject to the entire fairness test in or out of insolvency. And I think this raises the important issue that when you're in a distress situation, you need to the extent a party's conflicted, a director is conflicted, that director should make that conflict known if it's not known, and you need to at least have a majority of the disinterested directors make a decision. If you don't have disinterested directors, you may consider use of a special committee, or if you don't have any disinterested directors at all, I think you may want to consider adding some. So those are, and to remind people some of their basic corporate law and fiduciary duty issues. The other alternatives, which are never as palatable, is to seek approval of a majority of the disinterested shareholders as well. But I think to the extent you can keep those decisions at the board, there are ways to do it. Importantly, common stock ownership by itself, by the director or the director's employer, like a private equity board designee, does not in and of itself create a conflict of interest. Decisions relating to residual claimants in the order of the priority they have in the capital structure, those decisions are protected. When near insolvency, directors may, but are not, as we indicated earlier, obligated to consider the interest of creditors in concluding that certain actions are imprudent in light of the company's obligations to its creditors. So again, the best practices are for the board members, stay informed, consider, you know, whether it's appropriate to give any preferential treatment to certain stakeholders, rely upon, but work with management and outside advisors, and really bring a questioning approach to transactions that could be in hindsight viewed as hindering creditors or where the corporation does not. And we're not going to talk about fraudulent conveyance today, but you need to make sure, the board needs to make sure that the corporation gets equal value in exchange for anything that it sells or otherwise gives up. Next slide. The judicial review of distressed transactions, I think it's important. From an overall standpoint, the doctrines applicable to non-distressed transactions are the same ones that apply to distress, but the determination as to whether insolvency exists and you're on the proper side of that line in terms of who you're the board's acting on behalf of will be reviewed by the court. We've talked about business judgment rule versus entire fairness and when that applies, and obviously corporate waste and failed equity gambles or Hail Marys could be subject to adverse consequences for the directors. The next slide, which nobody you probably can't read it just looking at it on your screen, but I think this really illustrates what is really different about distressed M&A transactions versus a regular transaction. There are so many more players involved, and this is what makes, to me, the distressed M&A transaction the most challenging. If you look on the left side, there's the board and the management, and as is typical, you see the arrow going to legal counsel and banker or financial advisor. And that's pretty typical. Lawyers help advise on duties. They help implement any structure. If you go into bankruptcy, they help with that process. So if you have a private equity portfolio company involved, you may see two sets of lawyers, lawyers for the sponsor and lawyers for the entity itself. And the financial advisor roles are largely the same, other than they also may expand into whether or not one needs to file for bankruptcy. The restructuring advisor is different, and this could be there are a number of highly qualified restructuring advisors that get involved. They can be providing advice to the board and the management team, or they can even have, this can result in a chief restructuring officer placed inside the company. Companies are not that operate very well and are successful at what they do when they encounter distress situations can be severely overtaxed. Liquidity becomes an acute problem that requires much greater forecasting and there needs to be outreach to various constituencies, particular customers and suppliers, and the restructuring advisor helps with that.